I'm so honored. I'm really so honored. I have two handkerchiefs, two very lovely color-coordinated handkerchiefs in my purse under my chair. Anyway, if I cry, I cry. So I'm really cannot tell you how deeply grateful and thankful I am for this professional recognition. I would just say I noted in the program that I have had the privilege to meet or work with all of the Martha May Elliott winners since 1978, and I hope I've affected some people's lives the way that those people affected mine. My particular thanks to Hani Atrash for nominating me and believing in me and being a loyal partner in many endeavors, as well as to colleagues like Sarah Rosenbaum and Jamie Resnick, who wanted to be but couldn't be here, and past Martha May Elliott awarders Debbie Klein Walker and Mel Kotelchuk, who all submitted gorgeous letters of nomination, and I told them that no award could be as nice as those letters. But, you know, the award's nice. So as I accept this award, and in the little bit of a time that I'm allowed today, I want to talk to you about a life course perspective on risk and resilience, and I'm going to share with you some things based on my own trajectory and of 40 years of research on this topic. So over the past 35 years of my professional life, my own personal narrative has been simplified and fine-tuned in presentation to various audiences, and it has really served me well and motivated me to advocate for poor, vulnerable, and at-risk children, and it served as a powerful illustration on the occasions about why investment in every child is important, why every child matters, and why we need to make sure that we're not assuming that a child's not going somewhere because we don't see it that day. So my family was poor. We were living at 50% of the poverty level my entire childhood. That was as high as we got. My family had been poor over generations in the South, and my parents moved north from the Ozarks in the late 1930s to pick fruit. I'm the only one of my mother's five children who wasn't a teen parent. I am the only one who graduated from high school. And as I will show you, my adverse childhood experience, ACE score, was high. It's five, maybe six. By the time I graduated from college, I was really wondering, why was I a survivor? Why had I succeeded academically? And the answer, the easy answer for most of my middle-class colleagues, and actually the two people who read this lecture said the same thing, even though it's in there, that that's not the answer I want to hear. They said, oh, but you're so smart. They don't know my siblings. My siblings are brilliant. They didn't finish high school. They ended up as steel workers. My two sisters spent 30 years in the steelworks in Gary. They came out very old and tired, women who then lost some of their pension in union battles. This isn't about my brain. It's about what happened to me and all these factors that I think are an interplay of risk and protective factors that helped me to succeed, of resilience. So resilience refers to a dynamic process that encompasses positive adaptation in the context of significant adversity. You have to both have exposure to the threat, severe adversity, and an achievement of positive adaptation to talk about it as resilience. It's also, as eloquently described by Almaghem and Glandon, resilience is not the absence of PTSD any more than health is the absence of disease. So design of longitudinal studies of resilience probably started around the time I was born in 1953, and the children of Kauai's study, those children were recruited and they were born in 1955. By the 1970s, researchers were documenting the role of resilience in helping vulnerable children find a way to overcome risk factors. And as a graduate student, I read and then met and then listened to the lectures of Michael Rutter. I read and reread the work of Werner and her colleagues, and the work of Samaroff and Garmazi added to my understanding, but the literature's really grown since that time. And during recent years, the focus of the research has shifted away from the personal characteristics of resilient children. So this isn't, even though it's all about me, it's not all about me. Shifting toward an understanding of the ecological perspective and how protective and risk factors are operating in that ecological perspective, and particularly the community and the social supports, the family, the context in which that child is living. And more recent studies, including some that have come out in the last month, tell us again and again that it's harder for boys and it's harder for children of color than it was for me. So as research in resilience has evolved, it's become clear that positive adaptation in the face of significant adversity involves a developmental progression over the life course. And this more extensive literature gave me a basis for understanding how it's a combination of me, my family, the environment that I grew up in, with including critical or lack thereof supports from public policy programs. So I'm going to show you my trajectory and try to use it as a way for you to understand what we need to work on. So this is my whole trajectory. I actually sat down, I did it multiple times, I sat with pen and graph paper, and I charted. Okay, so this was a plus 5, and this was a minus 2, and then I got a boost to 10, and then I went back 3. So that one line that zigzags all over the place, that's my life course trajectory. Not very smooth, but a generally upward trend, as we like to say. So let me tell you a little bit more about this. In my early childhood years, I experienced multiple risks and traumas. I was born healthy, but my mother's depression and reactions to her own childhood traumas affected me from the very start. Brain cancer led to the death of my father by the time I was 3, and during his illness, I lived for months with another well-functioning family who would provide a long-term prospective set of experiences in informal foster care. My siblings were 10 to 17 years older than me, so they were able to provide nurturing, making me, for example, an early reader. But a kindergarten experience with 12 substitute teachers and a rat-infested school was not really an optimal start to my formal education. So with the exception of income support from Social Security survivor benefits, so like turn the fact that your father died into a positive, few public policy programs were available in the 1950s Rust Belt in Indiana where I grew up. So I've listed on each of the next couple of slides the things that I think would have helped me, given my risks. And so thanks to federal action, most of these supports are available to children. But with wide variation in communities and in states, there are real gaps. I don't know why governors keep saying they ought to decide what the children in their state get, like the kids in Indiana don't deserve what the kids in Illinois get. But notably, if you went over the border and you went back to my hometown today, children would not have adequate child care, adequate wages for their parents, home visiting, or early childhood mental health as things from this list. They are not routinely available to children in that community. So in my middle childhood, I got glasses. But there were new risks and traumas and protective factors emerging. I had a stepfather who was an extremely effective and nurturing parent who came into my life for a few years. We moved to a good neighborhood and I went to the best school. Recognizing my interests, my mother made sure that books were available. Neighbors, friends, and family made sure I had a ride to Girl Scouts and the 10 cents for the dues and made sure that I got to church because my mother was working as a waitress. But baby bottle tooth decay without adequate treatment led to the loss of my front teeth by age 9 after a lot of pain in that process. My sexual abuse began shortly after that. And those things combined in turn led to obesity and bullying by my late elementary years. I moved to live with my oldest sister in New Mexico for 6 months, and that brought me again into a nurturing and structured family setting. With exercise and diet changes there in New Mexico, I was able to enter adolescence at a healthy weight with a lifetime commitment to exercise. And despite my own personal resistance and no parental intervention, a remarkable medical school principal insisted that I move into a college prep track. Pulled me out of general math, pulled me out of general English, said, you will go there. Now, I did not want to go there. I didn't want to sit with those rich kids. I didn't want to have my clothes be made fun of. I preferred to stay with those people who were familiar and comfortable to me from my home community. But obviously, it was a critical turn in my life. So from a program and policy perspective, access to health care, mental health, dental care would have all made a difference. After-school care, child health, school lunch, and some more access to the library would have also made a difference there. So in my adolescent years, I found that it really is a situation where I don't have that page of my talk. So let me just be sure it's not here. I may just talk it to you. This will take less time looking for it. There we go. As shown in a variety of studies, there are multiple risks and traumas start to accumulate and begin to show up in adverse outcomes by the time young people enter their adolescence. So in my teen years, I was depressed. I engaged in multiple risk factors. I once said to the Society for Adolescent Medicine, if you can think of every risk factor you ever thought of about a teenager, yeah, I did that. My siblings, again, contributed, making sure I was using contraception to avoid their teenage parent experience. And in the 11th grade, a high school teacher, Mr. De Los Alonso, saved me from being expelled due to too many absences. I had straight A's. I didn't know you could fail for too many absences. And he mentored me toward college applications and SAT and attendance at a small supportive college. There was nobody else in my family or community who knew how to do that, who knew how that worked, and could help me get through that process. In college, I thrived in an environment where many of my peers had rejected social class. Thank you, many of you probably too. And social activism was valued. I had a widening opportunity to spend my junior year in France. But here again, there were unmet program and policy needs. The routine health and community supports were not available in Indiana. They were the last state to adopt Medicaid and EPSDT, and they only did it under threat of lawsuit from Sarah Rosenbaum, actually affecting life again. Also, what we know is that many first in college attendees need critical mentoring at this point in their life, in high school and in college. Now, I had that, but this should not be left to chance. It shouldn't be random. So in adulthood, we know from the literature that positive life trajectories can be created by opportunities in the third and fourth decade of life that lead to enduring changes. So this was the case for me. I was able to work off my small student loans by working in child care. To get a master's degree, I actually was able to afford 2 degrees at public universities through minimum wage work. I don't think anyone could do that today, even at a public university. And 2 special public health mentors made a huge difference in the way that my life was going. Dr. C. Arden Miller, another page here, sorry. Dr. C. Arden Miller was pivotal in a process that changed my life from a minimum wage child care worker into an MCH professional. Also, thanks to Arden Handler and Amy Fine, who isn't here today, but Arden is, because they taught me what MCH was. Dr. Miller raised his voice to overcome faculty objections to my acceptance into the UNC program, perhaps because he saw in me, as it said in his obituary, a young person who wanted upward mobility from meager circumstances and a career that would do good. His confidence in me and my ability to use my voice as an advocate for maternal and child health provided water wings that I used to start swimming in national policy. The year I went to Washington in 1984, Dr. Miller received the Martha May Elliott Award. And 30 years later, I can think of no one who deserves more credit for launching my career in MCH. We will all miss the late Dr. Miller. Another work-life mentor, Sarah Rosenbaum, had similar confidence in me and provided coaching in policy, advocacy, writing, and speaking, all that I would need to fulfill my career goals. Few and large national organizations are willing to nurture students and young staff from disadvantaged backgrounds, yet Sarah truly does. I was the first to benefit from her commitment, but she's mentored dozens of others from low-income and disadvantaged backgrounds, and these individuals are MCH professionals, lawyers, and public health policy leaders today. The availability in the policy side of federally funded family planning clinics and federally qualified health centers. I was a patient of both in my young adult life when I was uninsured and had no days of paid leave. Yet the policy constraints, along with the recession at the time I graduated, put another damper on my development. For me and for millions of young people graduating from high school and college in this recession, research shows us that these will have a depression on lifelong earnings. People graduating from high school in the past 4 years will have that a depressed effect on their whole life and their earnings as a result of leaving school during a recession. So in the interest of time, let me summarize a little bit more how research describes where we're going and what we need to do. There are, up in the corner, 3 sets of factors that differentiate resilient children who overcome the odds. Those things within the individual and and that's temperament and language, communication, planning skills, a bunch of stuff, protective factors in the family, or with one competent, caring adult, at least one, and protective factors in the community that give positive support and experiences of competence. There is this staged recovery opportunity as a positive shift with opportunities in the third and fourth decade, but the literature is very clear that there has to be some process for recovery of mental health in order for young adults to take advantage of those opportunities. So I think that all of us have an opportunity for action, and I believe there are some key opportunities for us. First, we need to integrate the concept of resilience as we embrace the life course perspective. It's Maternal and Child Health Bureau deserves credit for getting us started in national surveys, helping us measure. But measuring ACE scores, defining toxic stress, drawing better or worse trajectories, and tallying up, counting again and again the disparities are not going to get it. That's not the work. That's the grounding for the work. That's the prelude for the work. We got to do the work. We also have to avoid a deterministic tone in our work on the life course and its trajectories. You have to account for the fact that many who have overcome the odds are working among you, and not everyone like Christy Bethel and I are willing to stand up in front of hundreds of people and shout about it. Every time I give a talk like this, somebody comes up to me afterwards and says, "That happened to me. That's like me." They don't want to talk out loud about it, but we can't do an us and them thing about this. Second, we need to align our work to promote resilience in the context of social determinants of health. The conceptual frameworks align well, and there are commonalities, and understanding the processes, programs, and policies that contribute to resilience, including the social determinants of health factor, may be critical for us to overcoming those social determinants of health. Assuring equity will require such alignment and perspective as well, I believe, and I think the literature is starting to tell us that, but we haven't thought enough deeply about that. Third, grounding our public policy agenda, we need to put forth policies and programs such as those I've mentioned, and Werner told us that our findings alert us to the need for setting priorities and focusing on children and youth who are most vulnerable. We have investments in home visiting as a good step. We have insistence on early care and education as another, emphasis on well-being of mothers and women before, between, and beyond pregnancy another, the interest in supporting the transition from youth to adulthood for special needs is another, again, our focus on equity and social determinants of health and moving into a larger arena, all good, but we've got to keep that work going so that every child has those opportunities. And last but not least, we need to mentor students and young professionals. All of us as MCH leaders must do more to shape future policies and programs armed not only with the life course perspective, the social determinants of health framework, and an enduring commitment to equity, but equally with a greater knowledge of the concept of resilience and the well-being of future generations. Just as I leave the stage, I'm going to put up a slide from the CAMI and Academy Health Addressing Adverse Childhood Experiences Project. If you don't know about it, I hope you'll go to their website and learn about it. Thank you so much for this honor and the pleasure of speaking with you.
So thank you, Kay, for a moving, personal story of your life, and I think we have all been touched by that, and as well as your fine contributions. Thank you all for coming. Our Martha May Elliott Forum is next door, starting at 2:30. We actually have a discussion about ACEs tomorrow in the 10:30 to noon slot that Debbie Allen had helped put together, and Christina Bethel is going to be speaking in that group, so please join us there. And I'd like to again thank all the people who are the award winners and their supporters, and please come up front for pictures afterwards. And thank you again. Have a wonderful rest of your conference, and stay in touch with the MCH section. Thanks.